News Talk 580 KMJ presents Hometown Heroes, honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, coming to you each and every Sunday afternoon here on News Talk 580 KMJ and KMJ580.com around the world, 24 hours a day. Each week, we visit with Valley veterans of World War II. No matter where they served during the war, their stories are always interesting. We're preserving a little history. We're also learning a lot. And if you're as young as I am, I hope that you're learning a lot about things that you weren't around to experience. And that's what we're going to do today. You've probably heard me talk a time or two about my hometown of Las Banas, as in Las Banas, California. There's another Las Banas in the Philippines that was the subject of some pretty big headlines back in February of 1945. One of the more impressive raids of a prison camp that ever happened. In fact, only recently, within the last decade or so, Colin Powell was quoted as saying that, quote, "I doubt that any airborne unit in the world will ever be able to rival the Las Banas prison raid. It is the textbook airborne operation for all ages and all armies." And we're going to hear from a participant in that raid today. I say Las Banas because I'm from the town here in Central California. In the Philippines, you might hear some people say Los Baños, but no matter how you call it, that's what we're going to talk about today with a Valley veteran by the name of Vartan Tarosian. Now, growing up in the Valley, you probably knew there was a Las Banas 100 miles to the west of you or something, growing up on the east side of the Valley here. Had you ever heard of a Las Banas in the Philippines?
I had no idea.
Now, you grew up around the Reedley area?
Well, I was born and raised in the Dinuba area,
mm-hmm.
and moved to the Reedley area, and that's where I left for the service.
And your father had served in World War I, right?
Yes, he did serve in World War I. He was an immigrant from Turkish Armenia, and when that wholesale massacre of the Armenians in 1915 happened, he was here working for a Hood Rubber Company, mm-hmm. in a shoe manufacturing segment. And when they got news that they had lost their parents and their relatives and so forth, they somehow or another organized a battalion of Armenians, and through the sanction of the federal government here, they were sent to Russia for basic training.
Mm.
And subsequently, the Russian Revolution started halfway through their basic training, and so they were shipped back to the United States and deployed to into the French Army and on to the end of World War I, which was fought somewhere in the Mediterranean against the Turks.
Mm-hmm.
So that's how they got in. They were called the French Legion. And my father lost an eye and was wounded in the foot. And he almost lost his life because of loss of blood. But somehow or another, he survived and lived to be 103.
Wow.
He was quite a man.
And I imagine you heard a few of those stories growing up, huh?
Well, a lot of them, but some of them we were not even exposed to, because there was enough emotional expressions on the part of our parents that did tell us that there was something really wrong. But eventually we did find out what the big trauma was about in their lives.
Now, did that mean something to you to have a father who had sacrificed so much for not only this country but for his homeland as well?
At first, as children growing up, it didn't mean anything.
Mm-hmm.
And we didn't know about his one-eye situation until much later. And actually, I didn't appreciate his contribution to freedom until I got back from the service. We didn't pay much attention to it. And he didn't boast about it or anything, because it was a traumatic situation for him.
How'd you find out that he only had one eye? Did he pop out his glass eye and trick you or something?
Well, every once in a while he would break his right eye, because in farming and pruning vines and so forth, he would lose that one eye and break, and he would have a, he didn't have a patch. He just had a
bandana or something.
Bandana or something wrapped around it. We didn't know what it was about. He had that from us for a long time.
Wow.
And then one day I was snooping around in their room and I found this eye.
That throws you for a loop.
Yeah, I was curious. I was always a curious person, and then finally I realized what, and how this man survived with one eye. In what he did here, and fathering six children, and going through the trauma of losing half of them before he passed away at the age of 103. Amazes me how he endured that and lived to be that age and be totally sane and sharp of mind, memory and all.
Well, it makes you feel like you came from good stock and you got a ways to go here. So I know you've got plenty of time to spend talking with us about your experiences in the service. I like to ask each vet, each guest on this program, where he or she was and how he or she found out about the Pearl Harbor attacks on December 7th, 1941. Do you remember the first time you caught wind of what had happened there?
Well, I was on the radio. Mm-hmm. I mean, all over the place. You couldn't escape it.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know exactly where I was.
Did it mean something to you at the time?
Oh, we knew. We knew that it was a major, major attack on our country, and we knew we were going to be called on to answer that, you know, to go to war.
So did you do something about that, or did you wait till they drafted you?
I waited until I was in high school.
Mm-hmm.
I was still in high school. And I waited until I got my papers within a few months. I don't know exactly when, but when it comes as a greeting, it says, greetings, hello. But in any case, it means you're going. Well, Dr. McLaughlin, who was a principal of Reedley High, called me in and he said, you know, you're not doing too well in your studies. And he says, but you have just enough credits to graduate. That was in January of 43. And he said, you can graduate. Mm-hmm. You qualify to graduate. If you want to go now, you can. If you want a deferment, we can get you that. So what I said, well, let me think about it. And I thought about it, and I could have been deferred, and that's another story. But I said, well, I think it's my calling, and I will go. And
you say that's another story, and I think I know a little bit of that story. Someone basically told your father for $500 they could keep you out of the war. Is that right?
That's correct.
And your father brought that offer to you?
Well, he brought it to me. And, of course, everybody at that time was so patriotic.
Mm-hmm.
With either one side or the other, and we didn't know the other side. And I just told my dad that I said, it's my calling, and even if you pay it, I won't go. I mean, no, I will go.
Right.
I refuse that kind of deferment. And he was really proud of his son at that time. And to me, it didn't mean anything, but, you know, it was trivial. But I... Mm-hmm.
And so right away, did you know that you were going to be in the kind of unit you ended up in? Or what were you thinking when you joined the Army? Did you have an idea of what kinds of things you thought you would encounter and experience?
Had no idea, except I knew that I was going to go into the Army. And we were shipped out to Presidio of Monterey in a staging area. It was just like a military camp. Mm-hmm. We turned in our civilian clothes and was issued military clothes, and we were put on, after a brief orientation, we were put on trains, troop trains, and shipped all the way to North Carolina. We stayed on the same train. We didn't switch or anything.
Mm-hmm.
And went to North Carolina, and early in the morning, we... detrained at Hoffman, North Carolina. And we went to Camp McCall, mm-hmm. was built just for the 11th Airborne Division.
And when you heard 11th Airborne, were you thinking, wait, what are we doing up? What are we doing up in the air? What are they going to be doing with me? Did the idea of participating in a unit like that excite you, or were you a little nervous?
Didn't care.
Uh-huh.
I mean, we're 18 years of age, and we're gung-ho, and we're ready to go.
All right. Well, right now we're ready for a commercial break, but when we come back, we're going to find out where Mr. Vartan Tarosian ready to go, where he would go in the rest of the war, what kind of things he would experience. Hopefully we can squeeze it all into this hour. More of Hometown Heroes next on News Talk 580 KMJ.
This is Hometown Heroes. Honoring everyday Americans who answer the call of duty on 580 KMJ.
I know you've heard that tune a time or two. Vartan Tarosian sure has. He's our guest today. That performance there, the music performed there, by the way, by the Sounds of Freedom Band, a local band which you've heard from time to time on the program. I'll let you know when their next concert is coming up. That's a group made up from people age 15 to 90, and a great group at that. Let's continue now with Vartan Tarosian. We left him at Camp McCall in North Carolina, where he'd been assigned to the 11th Airborne. And at this point, you're a rifleman, getting a little work with machine guns as well?
Paul, rifleman, and but assigned to a machine gun platoon.
Mm-hmm.
And from there, I was called on to drive.
Now, they found out that you were a farm boy, basically, right? They found out you had some talents.
Yes.
How did that happen?
Well, they just came around and asked, have you driven truck before, and a tractor, anything like that? And said, okay, at 18, we did all of that on the farm.
Mm-hmm.
So I was on, after that, I was on detached service. So they would pull me out of my regular unit in the case of driving the entire 511th Parachute Regiment in our division to Fort Benning, Georgia. And we trucked them, I forget, it was 500 miles or something like that.
It's a long trip.
And drove back on 6x6, we called 6x6 trucks. That was six wheels pulling power to six wheels.
A little bigger than the tractor you were driving on the farm.
A little bit, yes. And then I would not drive for months after that.
Just whenever they needed you,
whenever they needed me, they pulled me off. And I was not very popular for that in my group, in my platoon, because oftentimes I would be driving and they would be walking.
Mm-hmm.
And when I went by them driving, I wouldn't even look at them. I wouldn't even talk to them because they had a scowl on their... Anyway, they didn't appreciate that.
I can imagine. Well, they ended up sending you to Camp Polk, Louisiana.
After Camp McCall,
mm-hmm.
We went to Camp Polk, Louisiana, and that was a final staging area to go overseas. And at that time, they suddenly changed orders or plans and said, we're going to turn the entire division into a parachute infantry. And it was a voluntary thing. Those that did not volunteer were shipped out to another unit. But of course, young and crazy as we were, sure, let's go for it, because it was a more prestigious,
mm-hmm.
and then also it paid $50 more a month, and that was big money.
That's a big difference. I can't tell you how many veterans have told me that the first rule of being in the Army is never volunteer for anything in the Army. But when they sweeten the pot with $50 extra a month, it makes it easier to volunteer. Did you have to go through any parachute training yourself?
Oh, absolutely. But mm-hmm. it was at Camp Polk, and we went through some rigorous training and physical training that we had never done before. forest march. It was a 25-mile forest march at nights and with a full field pack. Of course, we were in great shape, so that we made it quite well. And then, of course, after that, you go through basic jump training from a short tower and rigging, which is packing parachutes.
Mm-hmm.
And we had to pack our own parachute. So if it didn't open, it was a self-inflicted thing. We made sure it was right.
Doesn't make you feel any better when it happens, though. So from there, you find out?
From there?
We're heading overseas.
Excuse me. From there, we went to Camp Stoneman. We got shipped to Camp Stoneman by train in California. And that was our final staging area before we were trucked. I don't remember whether we trucked or bused to San Francisco onto a ship called the USS Cape Clear. Excuse me. And then we were on our way. We were on our way. But I can remember one poignant thing, if you might, for lack of a better word. It was drizzling rain coming down.
In San Francisco?
Oh, it doesn't happen in San Francisco, but it did that night. And there was a band playing there, a small band, and I thought that was about the silliest thing I'd ever seen. I mean, what was so festive about going overseas? But that band was playing. And I don't know, that just kind of stuck in my mind as a kid, 18 years of age. I was 19 then.
What was going through your mind as you sailed off? I mean, obviously, it's not going to get any prettier once you get across the ocean there.
Well, for some reason, we didn't think too much about it. There was always a possibility of torpedo attack.
Mm-hmm.
It took us 26 days from the time that we got on that ship in San Francisco to arrive in Buna Bay in New Guinea.
Mm-hmm.
And that's where we were unloaded. 26 days.
Did that seem any different to you when you got there? Was that a welcome to the war moment, or did it take a while before you really got a taste of what things were going to be like for you?
We knew that we were on our way.
Mm-hmm.
And there was a feeling of impatience, like, if we're going to do it, let's do it. But there was months ahead of us yet.
What was the first combat you saw? What was that first experience where you were shot at, or you had to shoot at someone else, or you realized, yeah, this is really brutal, this is war?
Well, we went from New Guinea to Leyte, the island of Leyte, which it had already been conquered, let's say, but there was still sporadic firing going on in pockets of the enemy. Mm-hmm. Here and there, and we would go on patrol, and we would hear shooting, but there was nothing really that hostile there. All we were doing is burying the dead from before, and that's another story. I don't know how to explain that, but when soldiers have fallen, they usually bury them in a shallow grave, and then they recover that body later on and take them to a central cemetery. Excuse me.
And you had to do some of that?
I was on that burial duty for seven days, and it was, it's not a very palatable piece of information, but when a body is decomposed as much as they were.
Sure.
And they were wrapped in shelter halves, and they were brought to this central cemetery on a plateau way up in the mountains. And I forget the name of the range mountains in Leyte. And we would bury them in the graves that were about 4 feet deep, just deep enough where animals couldn't get to them, and make a makeshift cross and hang their dog tags, what they call their identification tags, on that cross. You don't remember everything, but in this particular case, this particular action, I I do firmly remember, and I was with two or three other guys.
Well, how could you forget is the question that comes to my mind. It's about that time where we need to take another commercial break, but when we come back, I want you to tell us how you got your Bronze Star, and we also want to hear about that famous raid at Los Baños Prison, or Los Banos Prison, in the Philippines in February of 1945. Vartan Tarosian, our guest today on Hometown Heroes. We'll be right back on News Talk 580 KMJ.
On the front line of freedom, you're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler on News Talk 580 KMJ.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes. We're going to get a little tricky here now. We've been talking to Vartan Tarosian about his service in the war, and I teased you. I told you he was involved in the famous raid on the Los Baños prison. That was the former University of the Philippines, the agricultural school there, a small town, Los Baños, on the island of Luzon. Not to be confused with Los Banos here in the valley. It's a world away. And I told you that Vartan was involved in that liberation. Now we have on the phone from Porterville, Jim Innes, who, believe it or not, was one of the more than 2,000 people imprisoned there, prisoners of war, I suppose, even though they were civilians, held by Japanese forces at that Los Baños prison. Jim, how old were you at the time that you came into captivity there at Los Baños?
Well, at the time I came into captivity was in 1942, the first part of 1942, because that's when the Japanese occupied Manila. We lived in Manila, and the first internment camp we went into was Santo Tomas. There's a big university building in Manila.
Mm-hmm.
And so our family was interned there either interned physically in the camp or out on pass at the mercy of the Japanese for certain reasons of illness and things like that. So we lived in the occupied city of Manila from January of 42 until May of 43.
Had your family been there as missionaries, or what was your
No, they weren't missionaries. My dad worked as a commercial in the business of shipping,
mm-hmm.
commercial shipping. And then briefly he worked for the U.S. Army just before the war. My grandparents had been there since 1902. I mean, my mother was born in Manila. This was our home.
Mm-hmm. And how old were you at the time?
I was 12 years old when the Japanese took Manila.
Uh-huh.
I was 15 years old when we were liberated by the 11th Airborne Division.
Now, I want to get your take on how that happened, because as I hear it, one of the things that prompted the American action was the discovery of some intelligence that said all of those captives, all of those internees, were about to be executed, and that prompted that quick strike by American forces. What do you remember that experience being like? What was the first thing that you realized? Something's up here today, so this is going to be different than the last several hundred days in captivity.
You mean the day of our liberation?
Right.
Well, we had been seeing flights of American Navy bombers coming in from the Pacific Ocean, from Admiral Halsey's fleet, and they would go on bombing missions to Manila, which was only about 25 miles north of us, northwest of us. So we had seen other American aircraft reconnoitering the whole area. So that was a very hopeful thing to us, and we knew they would liberate us sometime soon, but when we weren't sure. There was no warning to the vast majority of the camp inmates that we were going to be liberated that day. One of the big elements of the liberation was secrecy, and so the first thing we knew on that particular day, February 23rd, was when we fell out of our barracks for a roll call, which was held outside in front of our barracks, and at that was at 7 o'clock in the morning, and just before roll call commenced, we saw and heard a flight of planes to the north of us, which was right in the location practically of the shore of that big lake Laguna de Baye, which was just north of us, and as the planes flew quite low in our northern sky and behind some trees, we saw objects dropping out of the planes. It was a flight of 9 C-47s, and we saw objects dropping out of the planes, and we said to ourselves, or at least I did myself, I said, oh, man, some of these American planes are dropping food to us now. We thought, I mean, food was uppermost in our minds because we were really on the edge of starvation. And then the bundles of food grew arms and legs, and I could tell right there, those people are men, and they're dropping in our northern at our northern horizon, so to speak. It was only a couple of kilometers away, maybe. And then all hell broke loose in a small arms fire, because the camp had been surrounded the night before by American forces. A reconnaissance platoon had infiltrated a couple of days ahead of time and allied themselves with a band, a battalion of guerrillas, Filipino guerrillas. And they had been waiting in the forests or in the brush, so to speak, in the agricultural brush and surrounding the camp the night before, and they immediately began to fire on the Japanese garrison, taking them completely by surprise. And that's when the bullets started to fly, and we retreated into our barracks and hit the floor so that we get out of any stray gunfire that was going on. That was the way the liberation started for us.
Well, and I can only imagine once it was finally over, what a relief it had to be for you.
It was delirium. It was absolute joyful delirium. We were crazy with joy, because before the gunfire stopped, there were paratroopers on the ground in our camp, coming through our barracks, telling us, "Get up and get out of here. We're taking you out." And those people looked like angels almost. In fact, that was their nickname, the angels, from some another another episode. But these well armed and active paratroopers were all among us and urging us to grab our minimum gear and get out.
Get ready to go. Well, it
was.
Vartan has been listening to you describe that, and I don't know that he's ever had the chance to listen to that from anyone who was a survivor, one of the civilian prisoners who was liberated that day. I think he has something he wants to say now.
Jim, I have the DVD on that particular action, and I was with headquarters company and also the 457 artillery, and we were on the outskirts of Las Banas, the city itself and the prison itself, and we had set up a roadblock, and that's where we came into the picture.
You were with the 457.
Well, I was not with the 457. I was with the headquarters company, 1st Battalion,
uh-huh.
But I was on detached service pulling one of the 37-millimeter anti-personnel. They were anti-tank, but they'd been converted to
uh-huh.
anti-personnel, and we had set up a roadblock, and we didn't really know that we were behind enemy lines. We weren't told that, and we were not even told that this thing was coming off.
Yes.
Until we saw the planes coming over, just like you did.
Uh-huh.
And I said there was about a dozen planes. You say nine, so we're pretty close to the, we're pretty close after 60 some odd years. And it was just a remarkable piece of military exercise.
And we're going to have Vartan talk about his involvement. He actually earned a Bronze Star for his efforts on the outskirts of the prison. You were in the prison, liberated there, and I know that you've been very involved since then to honor the legacy of the 11th Airborne and your liberators by supporting a school in the Philippines at the former site where you were held. What does it mean to you? I'm sure you've had a chance before to talk to some of the people from the 11th Airborne who helped liberate you. This isn't the first time, is it?
No, it's not. In recent years, I joined the 11th Airborne Division Association, which is a group of veterans of the 11th, and I was an associate member. Certainly wasn't a trooper myself, but because I was so grateful to that military unit I just jumped at the chance to meet some of them and to express my gratitude and to take an interest in their meetings. But I had met quite a few others and gone to several reunions.
What's generally the response you get when you go up to one of them and you say thank you, and they realize who you are and why you're thanking them?
And I go up to them and say thank you, right? That's part of my mission in joining the association, is to say thanks and say it again and again, because it was an extraordinary operation, just from the military point of view, but it affected so many of us civilian prisoners. After all, there were, in our own camp alone, there were 2,147 prisoners, men, women, and children, and the 11th Airborne got us all out of there with no serious casualties at all.
Isn't that incredible?
One or two people got nicked by flying bullets, but all 2,147 got out safe and sound across through Amtrak. The Amtraks were part of the operation coming across the water on that lake I mentioned, and every single one of us got to safety about 20 miles up the road in a Philippine prison that had been taken over by the Airborne as a military hospital. Was that Joe I was talking to a few minutes ago?
Yeah, Vartan Joe Tarosian, who earned a Bronze Star, and he hasn't even told us how yet, but we're going to get that before this program is over. Was there something that you wanted to say to him?
Yeah, I would like to ask him a question or two, but let's hear what he has to say. He was talking about being in the vicinity of the camp,
right?
With light artillery or something like that.
I'll tell you what. Let's hit our final commercial break here. When we come back, stay on the line, Jim, and we'll have Vartan share that story with you.
Okay.
And we'll see how much time we have left in the program. But thanks so much for being with us, and we'll be right back here on Hometown Heroes, News Talk 580 KMJ.
Now, more Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler on News Talk 580 KMJ.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes. As is usually the case, the time goes by too fast. We have about 10 minutes left, and I don't know if we can squeeze in. I know we can't squeeze in all of Vartan Tarosian's experiences. If we had more time, he'd probably tell you about the time he saw a Jeep driving in front of him on a road blow up and just around 30 feet away from him. It could have been him. He might tell you about driving Colonel Tipton up to the USS Missouri to take part in the official surrender of Japan in August of 1945. And he'd love to tell you about his brother who gave his life for our country, serving during the Korean conflict as a Navy fighter pilot. But we're going to continue to focus here on the liberation of Los Baños prison in the Philippines in February of 1945. On the line from Porterville, we have Jim Innes, who was one of the more than 2,000 internees, all of whom survived this daring raid by American forces who had been tipped off that those prisoners would be executed in the near future. So they acted swiftly in one of the most successful raids of that kind ever to happen in the history of the world. And I don't think Jim or Vartan would argue with that. You've heard Jim describe his circumstances. He was just 15 years old. They were all starving. They were in a desperate situation. But they were liberated because of the daring action and the sacrifices of American forces, including Vartan Tarosian, our guest today. So let's pick it up with what you did. You had been heading toward the Los Baños prison on a road from Manila. And they tell you, they grab you in the middle of the night. They don't tell you what you're up to. They just say, go to this position. Why don't you pick up the story from there?
Well, there was some planning, of course, prior to that for the number of personnel and the guns and ammunition and ordnance and so forth. So I don't ever remember leaving where we left from, but I know where we arrived. It was in the middle of the night, and all the, you know, the guns were set up, the anti-personnel.
And you had pretty clear orders. They said, if you see anything coming, shoot, right?
Once the personnel set up the guns, they said troops coming from that direction, fire away, because they will be the enemy. And of course, we didn't know we were behind enemy lines. I mean, they wouldn't give us that information because there would be probably a lot of apprehension. There would probably be a lot of nervousness. And so
it was a need to know basis, and you didn't need to know.
There was some drinks taken, you know, during the night, not to keep warm, but just to keep up our spirits and whatnot. And I didn't have very much, but the gunners had several, and the other guys did too. But anyway, that was just kind of not a ritual, but it's just something that did happen.
And you got through the night, but in the morning, things started to happen, right?
Well, it was early morning, like 3:30 or 4 o'clock.
Okay, still dark.
In the morning, and then we could hear the rattle of equipment coming from the direction that they were not supposed to come from, but they did. It was the enemy. And the gunner delayed firing, but within seconds, somebody hit him on the shoulder and said, fire. And so tripped it. And then these, of course, the ordnance is like big shotgun shells and ball bearings. And then everything stopped on the other side. It was only 30 yards face to face. So there was fixed bayonets. But it did come to that. They had enough personnel left on the other side where the rifle fire started. And also the mortar shells can start coming in, and that's where the casualties came in on the company that was assisting the 37 millimeter cannons, let's call them cannons.
Right.
And anyway, daylight came, and everything stopped. All the small arms fire,
it got a little quieter.
It got quiet. It got quiet, and the rifle company and sharpshooters, two columns went across this bridge over the railroad, and they just, the ones that, the enemy troops that were able to get away, they did.
Mm-hmm.
But the ones that were, they left their wounded behind. And I just hate to say this, but our riflemen went through, and they were given orders to shoot, to kill, take no prisoners. And that's, you could hear the rifle fire as they went through, and then they came back again. And then we started picking up the pieces, and the wounded began to be carried out. And I asked the lieutenant that was in charge, what are we going to, I mean, they were severely wounded, and I said, where's the medics? And he said, there are none. He said, we have to get them out somehow or another. And I said, well, what are we waiting for? And he said, well, I can't order you to do it. And I said, well, that's no problem. So
you volunteered.
I volunteered. It's just something you automatically do.
Got a couple guys on stretchers, loaded them onto the Jeep?
Loaded them onto the Jeep. One guy had his kneecap blown off, you know, and loaded them on the Jeep. And what I did was I didn't get into the Jeep. I worked it from my knees, started vehicle up and put it in a in low gear, and I just crawled into a safe, crawled along with the Jeep.
So this was still a dangerous situation. You could have been shot at any moment.
Well, there, yeah, I could have.
Mm-hmm.
But anyway, that was not something that I thought about. Yes, I thought about it, but it didn't. But anyway, I took the Jeep in a safe place and where the wounded could be carried out. So they brought the wounded out, placed them one person was able to sit in the front, and then they put the stretcher with the severely wounded in the back. So I went to the town, through the town of Los Banos, and that's where our troops were. So we unloaded them at a aid station, and I turned around and went back for another load. And after that, it's just almost a blank as to when we hooked up to the guns to get out of there and go back to a safe area. It's just kind of a blank. I don't remember, hardly remember that.
But somebody was paying attention because they ended up giving you a Bronze Star for evacuating those wounded men.
Yeah, it was unknown to me, and I didn't know about it at all. I mean, there was no presentation of any kind because we were very busy.
You were still busy.
We were still busy.
And you would have been busier. You would have had to invade Japan. Your unit would have been employed in the invasion of Japan if they hadn't dropped the bombs.
Exactly.
And I imagine that a lot of those, the wounded men that you evacuated were probably treated at the same aid station that might have been dealing with some of the internees evacuated from the prison camp itself.
Yes, but they were not severely injured in any way. But the real sad part of that Los Banos liberation was that the Japanese soldiers went back in on orders from their superiors, and it was a carnage that I've seen photographs of, but most people haven't. They went back in and killed all the Filipino people in the town of Los Banos for aiding and abetting the 11th Airborne.
Okay, I'd like to...
Feel free, Jim. We've got about a minute and a half left in the show here.
I'm so glad that Vartan mentioned that the precise last words that he mentioned here, and that was the information about the slaughter that took place in the town of Los Baños after we were liberated. We civilians were liberated and safe off in an evacuation hospital, just glorying in our freedom and the joy of being alive and being so safe. The Filipinos suffered. The Filipinos who had backed us morally and who had backed us very decisively with guerrillas. There were several guerrilla bands that joined together to lay the trap, you know, for the raid that came down, including paratroopers and including an Amtrak battalion, and then when we were gone and the whole area was more or less left open still, there were remnants of the Japanese who were not all killed in the attack on the camp, who came back and killed as many as 1,000 people. We don't know the exact number. Perhaps 1,000 Filipino residents, civilian residents of the town of Los Baños, who paid with their lives simply for being loyal to the American cause in a very difficult situation. I appreciate Vartan's mentioning that. I also want to mention a lot has been made of how narrowly we made an escape, that is, we civilians, because the airborne came in. There was a one company of airborne troops who actually jumped right next to our camp to complete the attack on the camp. But that was such an amazing feat of rescue, so successful and so forth. But I do not know, myself personally, I do not know of any significant evidence that said that the Japanese were going to murder us all or massacre us all. Some people try to make the whole story a little bit more thrilling, you know, by saying we were on the edge of the of the massacre. We were on the edge of the massacre by the Japanese, who were that very day going to, you know, wipe us all out. There's no significant evidence of that. Now, there's evidence in the history of the liberation of the Philippines where military prisoners were killed, massacred by Japanese captors.
Yeah.
On Palawan Island,
Palawan,
for example.
Palawan comes to mind, absolutely.
But I want to repeat it. There is no significant evidence that the Japanese, our garrison, our local garrison on the internment camp, were going to kill us that day.
Jim, I'm glad you brought that up. I think that was something that was glorified, that they were going to annihilate the entire prison camp, and I'm glad you brought that up.
Okay.
Well, I'm running out of time here, gentlemen, but whether they were going to kill you or not, I know that you're very thankful that things happened the way they did, and that it's sobering to think of the Filipinos who lost their lives in the aftermath, and that American soldiers lost their lives that day to liberate you.
That's correct.
Jim, is there any final thought you want to share with Vartan here before we sign off?
Yes. He covered the essentials for me. And sometime I would like to get together with him, you know, and a couple of history books, and we're going to talk about some of the other elements in this amazing raid that did succeed so gloriously for us.
And maybe I'll have you both on the program again sometime, too. I'm sorry that we have to cut it short here. Vartan, thank you so much for taking your time today. Jim, thanks for being with us. I'm glad that I could introduce the two of you, and I look forward to hearing about your conversations. And Vartan, thank you so much for serving our country and for being here today.
Thank you, Paul. I wish I was as well-spoken as you are. But then again, you're an expert in your field, so I commend you.
Well, I couldn't do what you did, I guarantee you that. We're out of time today. Thanks for listening to Hometown Heroes on News Talk 580 KMJ.